I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. We seem to think, thanks to technology, that we will live better and forever. That's obviously not the case, but from in front of the lens that shines on us, thanks to Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, we forget that the future is often bleak. We all die, even when we delude ourselves that we won't, and even though we do, it won't be for a long while yet. My two guests now ask the important question, what happens to your online self when you die? They are Angela Crocker and Vicky McLeod, the authors of a new book, Digital Legacy Plan, a guide to the personal and practical elements of your digital life before you die. It's from the folks at Self Counsel Press, and like most books from that imprint, it has forms, worksheets, and checklists in the book that one can fill out or download off their website. I'll ask Vicky and Angela about those and about those things that we're loath to think about, like just how much stuff there is of us online and what to do with it all. Photos, intellectual property, personal history. There's also the stuff stored online or on devices that contain passwords and other records. Who'll deal with that? And why is it important to think about this stuff and designate someone to look after it all? This applies to a lot of entrepreneurs who work on their own. Angela's been on the program before several times. She's been described as a pioneer of ethical social media. She's an author, speaker, and a member of the faculty at BCIT. She is the author of previous books, The Content Planner and Declutter Your Data. Vicky McLeod is an author, coach, consultant, and entrepreneur. Her previous book is Untrending, a field guide to social media that matters, how to post, tweet, and like your way to a more meaningful life. Ms. Crocker's Twitter handle is at Angela Crocker, and Ms. McLeod is at Vicky underscore McLeod. Please welcome back to the Plantathon program, Angela Crocker. Ms. Crocker, good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to the program, Vicky McLeod. Ms. McLeod, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us both. Found fascinating in terms of because it's in the subtitle of the book, Die, is death. Because it's something that we don't talk about, and we're so afraid to talk about it. I guess when one hits a certain age, well, and that's the other fascinating thing, that because people are dying a bit, who are online especially, at any age, it's something that we have to contend with. I'll begin with you, Vicky. Why do you think it is we're so afraid about talking about death?
You know, I think there's the whole notion of how we talk about death and deal with death. Partly it's cultural, so we have a different cultural bent in North America than there are perhaps in other parts of the world where they actually are more comfortable with the subject. Certainly those of us who came of age throughout the 20th century, you know, death became a very private thing. At one time, it was more of a community event. If someone died, the church bells rang, people came out, mm-hmm. they mourned as a community, it was more public. Then in the 20th century, death became almost sanitized, certainly in North America and probably Western Europe as well. So those of us who grew up in that particular time frame, which is, you know, most of us now, who are especially getting on to thinking about our legacies, we were sort of brought up in a way that it was something that was really not talked about. Families were more spread out, there was less ability for people to connect and gather the way that we can now do online, almost hearkening back to that kind of community mourning. Uh-huh. So I think it's partly just its cultural and social conditioning about how we deal with that subject. Also, we don't like to talk about our mortality. We like to consider ourselves to be immortal. It gets to be a little closer as you get a little older, for sure, but it's partly age-related as well.
Yeah, and Angela, I mean, death has changed in the 21st century, and that's largely because of social media, because of technology. In a way, it's made us closer to one another, but you know, all those things that we hear regularly about how isolating technology can be, I mean, those things come up, especially when death's involved.
Well, death comes up for us every day if we're using social media. Almost daily that you'll see a post about a celebrity's passing or suddenly find out about the passing of an acquaintance or someone who has the name friend through your social media connection, but maybe someone that's not as close to you as your inner circle. And so that notion of death is popping up more and more, and we're having to deal with the emotional response to the passing of a particular person, to the cultural impact of the celebrity and whatever their iconic contribution to our growing up has been. And day by day, we're seeing death more often. And yet, as Vicky said, you know, we're kind of afraid to talk about death and address our own mortality. As my dad is fond of saying, you know, we're all on the same path. Eventually, everybody will die. So how do we navigate that online when we can't really hide from death anymore as we become increasingly connected as a community through the Internet?
I'm going to jump around in the book because there's just a lot I want to talk about. One section near the end of the book that you write about has to do with digital memorials and obituaries and sort of the etiquette that one has to, I guess, navigate through online when someone dies. You mentioned celebrities, but beyond that, I mean, even people that you encounter briefly online, even there's certain considerations one has to make, right, in terms of how to, say, comport oneself online.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the things that we're finding a challenge in the 21st century is that we are not only becoming more aware of the deaths of those that are close to us. For example, you know, if we were to lose a child, for example, and that goes out onto the news feeds, and suddenly there's a sort of collaborative grieving or even grief jacking, we talk about a bit in the book, you know, mm-hmm. where that sort of personal grief suddenly becomes very public and people's opinions about that death also become part of the commentary.
Yeah.
Something that we have to learn to navigate. I think that's a really important thing to think about. But even those who are not, there are people that we're friends with, for example, on Facebook or Twitter, who we may not know well personally, but they announce that kind of very personal loss. And then what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate, and how can we start to learn to be sort of as sensitive online as we would be offline? I think it's a challenge. I mean, I hope in the book, we sort of, near the end of the book, talk about it, sort of territory that we're all in together and we have to figure it out together.
Yeah. I mean, Angela, when you think about it, there are certain things that need to happen in the conversation, in the discourse, things that need to change, say, that'll make it easier to, say, go about talking about all this stuff, right?
And part of that is about using the language. So much of how we talk about death and how we learn to talk about death towards the end of the 20th century was through euphemisms. We talked about people passing away or moving on or finding the light. But in truth, just as in sex education, we need to teach children the correct names of body parts. When we're talking about death, we need to name it for what it is. And people do die. People do die. And there is death in our day-to-day.
Yeah. Vicky, you're a consultant. That's one of the many things that you do, obviously. And that's something that I hadn't thought about until I read your book, Digital Legacy Planning, was there are things that you need to consider about the work that you do when you die, I guess. And that has to do not only with, say, correspondence, Or I should say paperwork or whatever that is digitally that you have of yours, but of say your clients, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're really asking people in the book to think about all the aspects of their life. And we want to be clear, if you are in a large corporation or a large organization, you likely have someone who is dealing with the plans for the organization mm-hmm. in terms of succession, whether that's succession of assets or succession of leadership, because you have the resources, and
right.
you probably have an IT department who's thinking about these things. So the book is really aimed, in some ways, not at that market, but at people who are running their own consultancies, for example, or people who are leaders in organizations that may or may not have yet reached a certain threshold of technical awareness, technological awareness. I work with some clients like that, actually. So we really ask people to consider this as part of their legacy planning on the personal side, but then also on the professional side, and to think through, what do you have access to that your clients may need should something happen to you, especially in a small consultancy like ours? You know, my husband and I have access to a lot of information about our clients, and we hold a lot for them. You know, we're kind of like
yeah.
an adjunct organizational brain, if you will, you know. So it's really thinking through, and, you know, one of the things I really love about how we approach the book was to have worksheets that people can take a look at and that they can use to identify their assets, and those can be easily translated into professional assets as well.
Yeah,
businesses like ours, they're kind of combined. You know, my access to my Dropbox account personally uh-huh. also is access to the Dropbox that I share with my clients as well.
Yeah, that's the thing that I hadn't thought about, Angela, in terms of conversations one has online. that it's a two-way conversation a lot of the time, and the other person's contribution to that, I mean, one has access to that, and one should guard that just as much as they would their own, whatever they're saying, right?
For sure, and it's an interesting phenomenon as we are increasingly connecting with people through chat groups on WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger, as we're using the comments feature in private Facebook groups or through Slack channels, Trello workboards, or any kind of tool, where sometimes that information can be very personal, and sometimes it's very unguarded. There is this sense that it is private, it's just amongst friends, but who's going to gain access to that social channel, whatever type? What does it say, you know, when you die? What if you don't have control to say that you know, horrible rant that you had to say about your coworker where you had an angry day? That happens to everybody at some point.
Yeah.
How awful if they should then uncover that statement after you've gone.
Right. Are there horror stories that either of you have experienced in terms of say, planning gone wrong?
I would say not quite yet. I mean, the book came out in March, and what we're finding is people are really reacting with, oh, my goodness, I haven't even thought about this. I need to think about it. So I think as we move forward, we're going to see more. I know one of the examples we use in the book came from one of my experiences where I am kind of a sounding board for a friend who's having a lot of challenges with their adult child and sort of confides in me and sort of seeks advice in the way that friends do. And my great concern is that when this person passes, which they will, when they die, their child will then have access to their accounts, likely as their heir. And I would feel devastated to think that this child would be seeing this commentary that really is about a moment in time and a specific set of challenges that family is experiencing. And I know that my friend has absolutely no intent that information about their child will ever belong to that child's will ever be in that child's consciousness.
Yeah.
So I think that awareness that Angela's talking about is, and we say a lot in the book, like, be really mindful of what you're posting and what you're doing now.
Mm.
Because we can plan, but there's also the unplanned. You know, something happened right now to someone, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in their messenger that they actually don't want anyone to see for whatever reason. Be thinking about that now while you're living.
Yeah, have you found, Angela, that you or people around you have, say, changed their habits online because of considering that?
I think they're thinking about changing their habits. The process of evolving into new practices, new things that they're going to do, takes time. It's a new way of approaching information, and we're human. We still want to connect with other people. We want to be able to have those conversations, and so figuring out ways to have the conversations and still protect privacy. So that's a thin line that we're still evolving as to how we're going to deal with it.
Yeah. Vicki, you mentioned some of the forms or the things that one can download as part of the book. One thing that I found fascinating was this self-care contract. What's involved with that?
It's really, you know, it was interestingly born out of our writing of the book. Our own personal experience as authors was that this territory is tender. And to go back to your first question when you asked, why do we avoid talking about death, I think it's in part because it is tender territory. We're opening ourselves up to our own fears and feelings about mortality. We're revisiting possibly the other losses that we've had in our lives, the kind of grief that we've experienced. And we even found as writers, we needed to sort of be sure that we were caring for ourselves well and being conscious of the process as we went through it. And that really, for me as a coach, it's an important, self-care is just an important principle, but we both felt that we wanted to open the book with that so that as people, if they're using this book because they're in grieving and loss, that they're actually first and foremost looking after themselves and that they're ready to tackle what they may need to deal with as they act as a digital steward for a loved one.
The self-care contract itself, Angela, is that something that you keep, that you update regularly, if you will?
Oh, very much so. What we've written comes from practice, both from myself and from Vicki. And the self-care contract really highlights for our readers that self-care isn't necessarily, you know, massages and fancy vacations. Self-care is about the daily acts of kindness that we do for ourselves and our family, a simple cup of tea, going for a walk, stepping away from screens, there's a whole variety of things, and what works for one person is going to be quite different from what works for another.
Yeah, and there's just so much to learn in your book that that one does, find what they think is useful for them and perhaps not ignore but consider but not put into practice something in their own life. In terms of wills and the sort, I mean, most of us have wills. A lot of us don't. That's something to consider in terms of if you're putting one together, if you want to add to one's will, just who has access to these various accounts and to this digital life that we have, right?
Well, I think we really feel that it's important that you name the person that you would like to have that access. We call them a digital steward in the book. So, and we want to be clear that's not a legal standing in the same way that your executor has a legal standing.
Right.
But you will, at least not yet. That may happen in the future. But for now, that it's important and that you have the conversation with that person so that they know that you've asked them to do that role and that you put somewhere in your records, either with your will or with your other important papers and documents, the access information that person will need, who that person is, and that you communicate that also to your family and to your executor so that everyone's sort of in the loop as to, so that if something happened to me and Angela suddenly steps in, my family knows that I said Angela is going to be my digital steward.
Yeah.
And I've asked her to do that role, and I know she understands enough about the technology to do it effectively and to be at enough of a distance to help my family through what they need to get through.
Right. I guess that's something that we increasingly need to talk about and consider, and maybe not even just one other person, maybe two, right?
Always a good idea to have more than one person involved in the conversation.
Yeah.
There may be somebody who's appointed to take the lead when the inevitable happens and someone dies, but having more than one person who knows what their wishes are then allows those two or more people to have conversations to interpret the wishes based on the realities of technology and society and access in whatever year in the future that death should occur. It's really important, too, that family members, as Vicki said, are aware of who those people are so that they can take comfort in knowing that they have that technical skill to execute the wishes to the best of their ability with whatever tools are available at the time. We just don't know where technology is going to take us. Things are changing extremely rapidly year by year, let alone decade by decade.
Yeah. I mean, in the book you talk about Facebook and Twitter. I mean, who knows 10, 20, 5 years from now, even if these things will be around, right?
Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that's really important that Angela raised is making sure that your wishes are known. Because you can appoint a steward and you can let everyone know that's who the person is, but unless you've also had the conversation about what you want done with your digital identity, that can become very difficult for your family because they may argue amongst themselves. But if you have made it clear, look, I want everything taken down, I don't want a digital footprint after I'm dead, then they'll know that. Or if you know that you do want to, you want to live on in digital immortality, then you can be designing your plan that way and make sure that the people that need to know that so that your steward isn't put in the position of having to interpret your wishes, but can rather execute your wishes.
Now, we're seeing a lot of memorial Facebook accounts. Is that process, is that difficult to say to do when someone dies?
More than ever before, Facebook is at the forefront of the digital legacy considerations. In life, a user can appoint a digital, help me, Vicki, what's it called? A digital
legacy contact.
Thank you. A digital legacy contact. And that person can then take charge of your profile upon your death. They can decide to leave it as is. They can memorialize the account. They can delete the account, or they can turn it into a new feature, which is called a tribute account, which still allows visitors to have a little bit of interaction with the deceased, which is an interesting evolution. Unfortunately, most other social media tools and digital platforms haven't yet really addressed this need for access after death. And I think that that's something, I'm sure Vicki agrees, that we're going to see more and more of over the years to come.
Yeah, I find it creepy sometimes when like Joan Rivers' Twitter account, for example, will tweet out stuff knowing that she's dead.
Tweeting from beyond the grave.
But that's another fascinating thing that you bring up in the book is that let's say your your digital steward decides to say close the account, well, somebody can pick that up, use the handle, and then do all kinds of nasty stuff with that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that this is again why it's really important to be clear about what you want done, because we sort of I think we use two terms. One we use is digital litter. You're in danger of just becoming digital litter. You're just out there randomly. Your profile's out there randomly doing things. Or the digital zombie, where you are gone, but your accounts have not been dealt with, and so you still continue to appear with, you know, the requests, the birthday wishes, and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, first of all, just for me is a little bit creepy, and I just find, you know, it's unfinished business, but there's also the impact that it has on the people that loved you.
Right, right.
When they're seeing these bits of you floating around in cyberspace that they weren't expecting to see and may not be ready to deal with.
I have on my face, because I add everybody that adds me on Facebook, because I think it's, you know, interesting conversations can come about. Also, it's a good way for me to promote this show if I need to.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there are a number of people who have died, and a number of people who have died without, say, leaving instructions as to how to handle the account. And so very often, especially when birthdays come up, you will have people message these folks who have died as if they're still alive. And, you know, it is really a waste of effort, I guess, and it obviously disingenuous at the same time. And so it shows the importance of having a plan, right?
There's certainly the importance of having a plan, but there's also the highlighted fact there that the notification of the death may not have been circulated in a way that it crossed that person's radar.
Mm.
I recently had a friend's birthday pop up, and he and I have only ever had an online relationship. We've never met in person. He lives in the United States. And when his birthday notice popped up, I realized I hadn't seen any content from him. So before I wrote the birthday message, or was about to write the birthday message, I went to his profile just to see what he'd been up to and catch up on his news, only to discover that he had passed away several months prior, and I hadn't understood that or hadn't seen a notice to that effect. So I do think that it's awkward as well for the person leaving the birthday wishes. They may sincerely believe that that person is still living.
Yeah.
And it's a real indicator of how hastily and quickly we are posting things online, sometimes without reflecting on the context of that message.
Yeah.
I found interesting in the book about passwords, because nowadays passwords are complicated, and they're made to be complicated by you know, websites and the sort. Vicki, what have you found useful in terms of not only how to remember them, but how to store them, say?
Well, for us, I mean, my method is fairly simple. We have a Dropbox where we keep all of our passwords stored, and of course, that's digital, so that's not helpful if the person can't get into my computer.
Mm-hmm.
So we also have hard copies that we have a small safe in our home where we keep all of our important documents, and our executor knows where that is and how to find it. And in that, we have a copy. And I just update it. Whenever I add something new, I have an additional column in there. You know, I have the username, password, and all the stuff. Then I have an additional column where I just put my wishes.
Yeah.
You know, wishes upon my death, delete this, keep until my people want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think my family, for example, may want my Facebook profile to stay. I don't care. I'd like it probably to go down.
Mm-hmm.
But my family may want it to stay up for a little while. So that's kind of what I put, keep up until you're ready to let it go, and then let it go. I have no desire to be digitally immortal.
Yeah.
So that each kind of each area, and then I've noted whether it's for business, whether it's got, you know, just some things have value, right? Points,
right.
Programs, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So just made little notes on the side, and it's very easy.
Angela, what have you found in terms of when you see these things all the time in terms of one password for everything, those sorts of things that one has to pay for, and the sort of, are those useful at all?
They're certainly useful because they offer a high level of encryption and the simplicity of remembering a single password to unlock all passwords. However, as we did the research for the book, we found that most people are resistant to putting all of that trust into those apps, and they have a resistance to it partly because they maybe don't understand how it works, partly because they worry that it's also the keys to the kingdom, if you will. If they should lose that one all-access password, they may inadvertently unlock their entire online self to someone with nefarious purposes.
Yeah.
So the one password, last pass, those kinds of things are certainly valuable. But we also have to ask people to be comfortable with what solutions they're using. And so the method that Vicky described just now are similar methods. We've even met people who have, you know, just a very few accounts, and they might have a physical piece of paper in their home that lists them. It's not ideal to keep paper records because they're easily damaged, but it's better than nothing at all.
Right. Yeah. Something you touched about just now, Vicky, is whether we should have an online legacy after we die. And I think that's something that, that we all have to consider and have to consider for each, I guess, aspect of one's life. I mean, the Twitter and the Facebook might be completely different in terms of how that's dealt with, right?
Mm-hmm. You may feel, yeah, and I think first and foremost, it's really personal, as you pointed out earlier. This is, you know, for each individual, it's going to feel different or be different. And I think, you know, I think for myself, certainly I'd like my body of work to live on, like my books and that kind of thing.
Right.
And if those have associated platforms that go with them to keep royalties flowing into my, towards my loved ones, that's great. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's, for me, that's the important part. But for other people, it may be important that their entire family history is preserved, or it may be important that they want their lives to go in. And we're even in a time where people can create very sophisticated artificial intelligence avatars, to the point, actually, where you could be giving advice to your children from beyond the grave if you chose to move on. Like, it's becoming, there's quite a lot, and I think we're going to see a lot more in the next couple of years emerging.
Yeah, it's unbelievable just how quickly things change, but how quickly things could change in the very near future. I think that's what scares a lot of people, right?
Yeah, and the choices we're going to be faced with making.
Angela, I began the conversation talking about death, but I understand you have a son. And,
I do, yes.
And I was just wondering, in terms of how you began documenting his life online. I mean, parents obviously take photographs and the sort, but knowing what to post and what not to post, I see a lot of parents online creating their own pages, their own Twitter accounts even. Just as the child is born. Did you have any advice in terms of how to go about that, if you're a parent, say?
I do. I would say what I did when my son was born is not what I would do today. I was quite free about sharing his image and small stories about him growing up when he was a baby, when he was a toddler, when he was a preschooler. As he went through elementary school, I became more and more judicious about what I shared. And when he got to about grade 5, he had a strong opinion about what was permitted.
Mm.
Now, I feel good that most of the content I've ever shared about him online is somewhat restricted. There are only certain groups of Facebook friends that can see those. Instagram posts typically don't show his face if he is in the picture. And as he's emerging onto social media himself as a teenager, he has private accounts that are locked down.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of the work that I've done as a parent has been a learning exercise. And I think as parents over this last 10 or 15 years have been evolving online, we're suddenly realizing how responsible we are for our child's digital footprint. And more importantly, for modeling and mentoring them on what's next and how do they come about in terms of managing their own digital footprint and what the ramifications of that will be when they apply to university, when they go to get jobs, should they ever choose to run for political office or some kind of security clearance-required position. This topic has been so fulsome for me, I'm actually in the process of writing another book right now called Digital Life Skills for Youth. It's a guide for parents and teachers to help guide this next generation of digital citizens in many of these issues.
Yeah, it's good talking again, Angela, and it's good to meet you, Vicky. Congratulations both on this book, and good luck with it.
Thank you so very much, Joe. Always good to talk.
The same.
Thank you.
The book is called Digital Legacy Plan, A Guide to the Personal and Practical Elements of Your Digital Life Before You Die. It is published by Self Counsel Press. Its authors, Vicki McLeod and Angela Crocker, join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.